Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Marcella Uhart about her experiences as a wildlife veterinarian in Patagonia in Argentina. Dr. Marcella Uhart has been a veterinarian with the Wildlife Conservation Society's Field Veterinary Program since 1996. She was born and raised on a ranch in the Argentine Pampas. From an early age, she was determined to become a vet to better protect the creatures living next to, and often in conflict with, farming operations in her country. The lack of wildlife subjects in local veterinary school curricula and her desire to work with wildlife led Marcella to become active in conservation organizations, volunteering in their offices and education programs while she was still a student. Shortly after, she had the opportunity to volunteer as a field assistant for WCS biologists and field veterinarians who were establishing a wildlife health monitoring program in Patagonia. It was there that she received her first training from WCS field vets and learned how she might apply veterinary medicine to wildlife conservation. That summer changed her life. Now Marcella is a WCS field vet herself. Since she started, she's worked tirelessly to address the critical shortage of training opportunities for young veterinarians in Latin America. Professional outreach remains a major focus of her work, as does collaborating with local universities and leading workshops in several Latin American countries. In working with the Wildlife Conservation Society, Marcella spends much of her time in the field. She often collaborates with numerous non-governmental organizations and researchers in Argentina and provides veterinary expertise in wildlife handling and immobilizations, translocations, and health monitoring of wildlife populations. She has worked on sea lions, elephant seals, penguins, small carnivores, caiman and raptors, as well as agricultural conflictive species such as rheas, large rodents, and large ungulates, including guanaco and pampas deer. Through her ongoing work with the WCS, Marcella has forged relationships with government agencies as well as local research institutions and has helped to introduce new policy measures to benefit wildlife. An example of this was the establishment of a program to control agricultural pesticide use, implemented with the support and endorsement of a research government agency known as INTA. As a consultant to field researchers and local conservation groups, Marcella has traveled to Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador, and other Latin American countries. In November 1998, she became one of the founding members of the first Association of Latin American Wildlife Veterinarians. She is also the IUCN's Wildlife Health Specialist Group Coordinator for South America. In this role, she hopes to reinforce and revitalize the relationship between wildlife specialists from the developed and developing nations. When I spoke to her recently, I asked Marcella what first got her interested in wildlife.
I don't know. It probably started when I was born. But basically, I grew up in a big farm in northern Argentina, and by that I mean very, very large extension of land. So I basically grew up on horses and dealing with animals every day of my life. And so becoming a vet was never a question. I knew I was going to do that from, you know, the day I had my own thoughts. The idea of being involved with wildlife, however, was more of an, I don't know, it kind of evolved more slowly, and probably as I was growing up, where, I mean, all my life I had, you know, I was always nurturing, you know, orphan animals out in nature and all those things. But the problem was that in Argentina, where I got my degree, there was no veterinary school that offered the option of studying, you know, wildlife as, you know, as a career that you, the path that you would follow in veterinary medicine. So I was, during my studies, I was very concerned about this fact, and I kind of went back and forth between, you know, should I continue with my veterinary studies, or should I instead, you know, be a biologist, or should I just, you know, go and work for the national park system or something like that, because I definitely wanted to work in conservation and wildlife, but, you know, the education I was getting was, you know, cows, horses, dogs, cats. So it was a slow process where I could finally, you know, merge my two interests and, you know, stick to veterinary medicine, which is what I really wanted to do, because I have always been very passionate about the power of healing, and at the same time, you know, be able to work in conservation, which was my other passion. But it was kind of hard for me to initially find a way where those two paths merge. I mean, it just kind of happened naturally once when I volunteered for a response to an oil spill in penguins in Patagonia many years ago. I guess that was the 1990s or 1991 or something. And when I volunteered for that project during that big problem, actually, I think it was like the major oil spill ever affecting Magellanic penguins. And I kind of realized that there were opportunities and there were, you know, where a veterinarian had so much more expertise than the other people who were involved in that process, and that there was a field there, you know, that was available and vacant actually in this country. So kind of that's where I started my path. And over the following years, I continued to volunteer for penguin projects, and those were actually run by the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is where I work now. So kind of like from there on, one thing led to another, and I finally was able to find my way.
You were just talking about penguins. What was the work that you were doing? There was an oil spill that was affecting the penguins in Patagonia?
Yeah, the initial project I was involved in, I mean, was actually a response to an oil spill. And later, through the people I met in that situation, I became engaged in a project. Actually, it was a very long-term project run by the Wildlife Conservation Society in Patagonia, led by Borsma. And she's basically once all her life. I think the project is now about 35 years of continuous study of some of the major colonies in Patagonia. So I began basically working in my summers as a volunteer for that project, and it was mostly biology work. It kept me close to nature and feeling good about conservation, and it helped me find ways in which I could apply my veterinary skills to answer questions that were not really asked by the program at that time.
Most of our listeners don't realize that the Patagonian large marine ecosystem is actually one of the largest and richest marine ecosystems in the world. And I'm wondering if you could describe this area. I know I've never been there. And so what does the environment look like? You know, how harsh is the weather?
Patagonia is a place that is hard to describe. I mean, definitely for me, and it has a charm that it has for Darwin. I mean, he traveled basically, you know, through a lot of the world and was always thinking about returning to Patagonia someday because he was completely enchanted by it. So many people think it is a flat and not very beautiful desert. With the desert landscape, the harsh weather conditions, it's how hard it is living here for all creatures, plants and animals, with the wind and the cold and the drought there. It doesn't really rain here at all. So just, you know, to imagine how everything here adapts to those conditions. And then where I live is the coastline of Patagonia, and that is just fantastic. It's green, blue ocean that is so rich and wildlife, and the contrast between the desert landscape and the ocean is unbelievably beautiful for me. And the wildlife spectacles that you see here, you basically can't see anywhere else in the world. Right where I live, we have I live near Peninsula Valdez, which is a World Heritage site, and it's a breeding ground for southern right whales. So they come every year to have their babies, and it's a being around also for southern elephant seals, for southern sea lions, for Magellanic penguins, for rockhopper penguins, many birds some birds in the albatross family, like the southern giant petrels, cormorants of many kinds, and then all the terrestrial mammals, which I find fascinating also, such as guanaco, which is a relative of the camel of the domestic lamb llamas. Yeah, I mean,
what does that look like?
Armadillos. They look like very elegant camels with no humps. They're just so cute. They have the cutest eyes and eyelashes in the world, and they're just so majestic in the desert. And with them live Patagonian cavies, which are really very large rodents. Rheas, there's Darwin's rheas here, which are pretty amazing birds. One of the most common smaller birds that we see around is elegant crested tinamous, which are very cute also and have the same breeding system as rheas, where daddy is the one who's in charge of incubating eggs and taking care of the kids. So I don't know. There's so much wildlife, and it's just a fascinating place to be.
Is it very populated with people?
No, that is the other thing I love. So Patagonia is kind of this triangle at the southern tip of Argentina, and it has a very extensive coastline, and then also it extends into the Andes on the west. So you go from the desert environment by the sea to very beautiful forests and mountains and huge lakes. What I've seen in the Uxatuctema area of Patagonia is Gran Teton National Park and Wyoming and kind of some of those areas around there. But that is very beautiful as well. But like in all forests, it is very hard to see wildlife there. The country and the sea and the coastline where I live, because it's so flat and so barren, and I mean, you can see so much wildlife everywhere. And also because of the richness of the sea itself, there's many, many of the animals come here to breed. And people, there are not that many cities around just because it is hard. The conditions are hard here, harsh. So for many years, there weren't even very many settlers just because of the restrictions and water availability, which is still a major constraint for development.
Given that there's not huge human populations, what are the main threats to the wildlife in that area?
You know, you would be surprised by the amount of damage that very few people can do. So, yeah, definitely if there were more people, the threats would be more in relation to urban areas mostly. But really related to cities, there's a variety of threats that go from anything from waste disposal, urban dumps are a big problem. Most of them actually are open dumps, so there's no burying of trash. So the plastic bags fly all over the place, and many of those plastic bags end up in the stomachs of marine creatures, including birds, sea turtles, and you name it. And it also promotes the kind of a population explosion of some of the most adaptable species, such as the kelp gulls, for example, which thrive based on human waste and then become a conservation problem for other species because they compete with other birds, for example, or can act as vectors of disease going from the dumps to, you know, isolated areas and things like that. There's also Patagonia is a big place because of its history with dinosaurs. It's a big place for oil mining, oil drilling. So that is an issue, as I mentioned before. For years, oil spills were a huge conservation problem here. And then also fishing is a problem, coastal fishing and also industrial fishing. There's a lot of artisanal fisheries, and most of those use for shrimp bottom trawling. So that causes a lot of damage to the sea creatures that breed there.
For the fishing, it's mostly artisanal fisheries, or it's really both the commercial or larger scale fisheries as well?
Oh, it's both. I mean, bottom trawling, it is really not artisanal. And I mean, it's not a tiny little boat that goes out for a day with one person. These are what they call one moon season. So it's basically a month, which is a full moon cycle. And harvest shrimp, for example, that is bottom trawling. And most of that occurs in areas that are very rich, which is, you know, not coincidentally, of course, those are the same areas where all the wildlife go to feed, because that's where the food is. So wherever these, you know, these fisheries operate, whatever scale, and we can get into the commercial, industrial, you know, big fisheries later, but that, because that is a huge issue on its own. Where fisheries are, basically because of the richness of the fish, or, you know, other species that they collect in those areas, which are obviously the same areas that the wildlife use for feeding, you know, especially elephant seals, the sea lions, the penguins, for example.
Now, since you've mentioned the elephant seals, I know you've done a lot of work with southern elephant seals. And I was wondering if you could tell me about some of your work in this area. And also maybe describe the elephant seals. You know, how big are they, and how do they compare? How do southern elephant seals differ from northern elephant seals?
Yeah, elephant seals are one of the most fascinating creatures on Earth. I just love them. And they are, despite their size, and people consider ugly in some cases because their big nose, their big proboscis. I think they're just very cute. And
I actually love them too. I love walruses and elephant seals, and maybe the uglier the better.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't know. You know, it's just dealing with those massive bodies, and then, you know, looking at them and seeing that, you know, or thinking about, you know, the tiny little fraction of their lives that we know from observation, which is what occurs on land, which is where they are awkward. You know, that is not their environment. Their environment is the sea, and that is why they have that huge body. And, you know, they're amazing creatures. They dive to, you know, 1,200 meters, they hold their breath for 120 minutes. I mean, they don't get the bends. I mean, they do all that naturally. They travel the most amazing distances. And, you know, and of course, we never get to see all that. We only know that because, you know, nowadays we can use transmitters that we place on the animals and then follow them when they're at sea. And that is how we learn about their behavior. So, you know, I just think that they're just amazing creatures. And my work with them has, to a great extent, been related to providing the means for biologists to undertake those behavioral studies. So I'm responsible for anesthetizing the elephant seals on the beach and allowing them to deploy the instruments on the animals, which for the most part are placed on their heads. They're glued to their heads with epoxy, and, you know, they later shed that during the year when they shed their fur. So it's there's very interesting. Southern elephant seals are very similar to northern elephant seals. They're a bit larger in size for the most part, both females and males. Males here, southern elephant seals are about 3,000 kilos. Females are much smaller, at about 800, 900 kilos, maybe.
Wow, that is a lot smaller.
Yeah, I mean, the sexual dimorphism is very marked in this species. But in relation to their northern cousin, they're really not that different. They're from the same genus, actually, Mironga. So, but what sets them apart in terms of conservation concern and other interesting facts about their life histories nowadays is that the northern elephant seal was hunted almost to extinction. So basically the population that you have now in the U.S. comes from a very, very limited number. It comes from about 100 individuals that remain alive. So it has reboosted from that, which makes them all genetically quite similar to each other, and therefore probably more susceptible to, you know, disease or any kind of, you know, event that could affect them in the future. Whereas the southern elephant seals were hunted very heavily, but they never got to such low levels as the northern ones. However, the southern elephant seals are not doing that great either. Nowadays, particularly the population that breeds at Peninsula Valdez has been increasing for the last 10 years. But it is very, it is unusual. Most of the other colonies, the breeding colonies for southern elephant seals are around Antarctica, mostly subantarctic islands like South Georgia's, the Falklands, and others. And in those locations, they haven't been doing so well over the last few years.
What are the main threats to the southern elephant seals? Is it the oil drilling and overfishing as well?
I wouldn't really know exactly which one was the main one. Definitely oil spills affect mostly coastal animals. So they affect a lot of seabirds that specifically need to use coastal waters, especially during the breeding season, because they can only forage, you know, short distances away from the colony because they have to come back every day and feed their babies. But for elephant seals who basically wander across entire oceans, mostly their main struggle nowadays is probably related to it probably occur at their breeding locations because they're very tightly packed. So if there's a disease event, many of the animals are affected at once. And then for the most part, the main issue is competition for food. So that basically relates to overfishing probably, and you know, who knows what the climate change scenario might be for, like, we still know that yet.
Now, I know some of your research was looking at how the blood cells of elephant seals change as they develop, mm-hmm. As they, you know, basically grow from juveniles to adults, and how that allows them to actually dive so deeply and hold their breath so long. And so I'm curious both how you undertook that research and, you know, what you found.
Yeah, that was a very interesting study. I also did one on, I was actually working initially on a study looking at their immune system. So I was trying to figure out how newborn elephant seals develop their immune system before they were weaned and had to live on their own. So elephant seals have very interesting life histories because they are weaned. They remain with their mothers only for 3 weeks. For the southern elephant seal, that is about 21 days, plus or minus 3 or 4 days. So basically, a little baby is born, and within 3 weeks, he's on his own.
That's not so very that long means, time.
I know. It's really hard to imagine a mom, you know, baby bond forming in such a short period of time. But their life together is very intense. And basically, mom, the only thing mom does in those days, she fasts. She's not eating. She's on the beach. And the only thing she does is just nurse her pup. And the pups are very, very demanding. They always want more, more, more. And they grow from about 30 kilos or 20-something kilos when they're born to 120 or 150 kilos by the time they wean, and that's only 3 weeks. So they're pretty amazing creatures. So together, then developing those fat stores, because after weaning, they stay on the beach on their own for about a month and a half or 2 months before they finally go away to the sea. They have to build up fat stores, but they also have to develop a very strong immune system because they're all together on the beach outside of their you know, water environment. And then also they have to become diving creatures. So our study looking at the evolution or how they developed that capacity was looking at the red cells of newborns. And in that case, what we found was that they resemble those of any terrestrial mammal. So they're born with, you know, normal, what you would call normal blood cell counts, red blood cell counts for, you know, most terrestrial mammals, be it a dog or whatever. And over those 3 weeks, that begins to change. So some blood parameters vary. And by the time after the 3 weeks and then a month and a half that they stay on the beach, so about 21 and about 45 days, so about 60 days, that is 2 months or something, they basically transform into a diving creature. And they do that by reducing the number of red cells in their blood, but increasing the size of those red cells enormously. And actually what they can do is that instead of carrying at one molecule of hemoglobin, and the red cells, like we do, take oxygen to their body, they have three molecules of hemoglobin. So they have three times as much oxygen carrying capacity in their blood than we have. And that is how they can hold their breath for so long with no problem. You can come to the beach anytime and find an elephant seal sleeping a nap with his head underwater and watch him for an hour, and he won't ever come up to get a breath.
Makes it hard for the life of a biologist, or...
Yes.
So how did you do that research? How did you take blood from the newborns to study it? Very carefully.
Very carefully. Actually, I had to deal with mom first. So in my biology study at the same time, I needed to see how the mothers transferred their antibodies to their pups. So I was actually anesthetizing the mom so I could get samples from them, both blood samples and milk samples, how those antibodies were transferred to the pups. And then I managed to handle it, because when they're tiny, they're okay. You can just handle them, just physically restrain them. You don't need to use anything else, and you can collect blood sample from them. As they grow, then I actually had to anesthetize them as well. And because even though they really are not aggressive and don't bite, quite, you know, large, and you can't really handle them or work easily with them otherwise. But it was very challenging. Sometimes I would find, you know, I was following the same individuals, and I had about 80. Every 2 or 3 weeks, I had to go and sample the same animal. So, and sometimes, you know, my animal that day was, you know, just sleeping in a high bowl. So, you know, you just couldn't work that day. So you had to go back a different day and try and find them on dry or on dry land. But you could anesthetize them, and, you know, they wouldn't drown during the process. So it was very challenging, but very, very nice, very rewarding as well. They're just, because they're so amazing, really.
How did you find the same animal? How do you identify an elephant seal?
It is very simple. The way we actually write names on them with hair dye.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when the pups are very young, their fur is black. And so in those days, when they're at that stage, what we do is give them a name, whatever. I mean, each elephant seals breed in harems. So what I would do was try and use some sort of theme per harem. So, you know, one harem was the universe or something like that. So, you know, the elephant seals that were being born were Mars, Venus, Jupiter, you know, depending on, and if it was a girl or a boy. And you know, I don't know, others, you know, another harem might be food items or whatever. And it was pretty silly because what's called soup and, you know, things like that. So when they're young, their fur is very black. So I used to use bleach. And then when they wean, they molt their fur. So it's a very beautiful silver-like gray, very soft. And in those days, I used to use black hair dye.
And then for the moms, you do the same thing with black hair dye?
Yeah, because the moms are not so approachable. What for the long-term studies of the animals, we use tags, it's kind of cattle tags, the ones that put in the ears of cattle. So those same tags, we put them on the flippers of the elephant seals. So they have a number and they're tagged. It's like wearing an earring that has a number on it. So for years, you can know who that individual is, and you can follow them for many, many years. So when the season begins, when the females start coming to the beach to breed, we walk the beaches and we try and find females that we know. We see their numbers. With that number, we go to our database, and there in that database, we usually have a name for them. So what we would do later is stamp the names on them. You can't really approach them and mark them without them knowing and without, you know, being attacked. So we would use a pole with a flat surface, and we would write on that surface with black hair dye, and we, you know, mirror-like style, so you write backwards, and then you would just, with a long pole, just kind of, you know, stamp the name on them and run away before they got you.
I've got this image.
Yeah. So actually, that's the way I anesthetize them also. I use, you know, it's used for giving IV fluids to people or animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I attach two of those, which is about 3 meters. And then I use a syringe and a very long needle. So I walk up to the elephant seals without them knowing that I'm there. And I punch them with a needle. And then I have about 3 meters kind of a room to back off and inject the anesthetic before they actually can get me. And I run off with that. It's pretty interesting.
Now, I'd like to switch species, but stay in the marine environment and talk about your work with whales. And I understand that almost a third of the world's remaining southern right whales breed in the waters along the coast of Patagonia. And can you tell me about right whales? They're baleen whales, correct?
Yes. Yes. Southern right whales are baleen whales. They're closely related to the northern right whales, which you have in the U.S. But compared to the northern right whales, these are doing fairly well. The populations have been, for the most part, increasing since whaling days when they were pretty decimated. But their numbers are still, you know, in the thousands and not in the bare few hundreds like the northern right whales. So, southern right whales are very amazing creatures as well. They come to Peninsula Valdez every year to have their pups and breed. So here, for their calves are born, they come every year in late May or early June, and they until late November, early December, at which point they travel to subantarctic waters where they spend what would be the southern summer, which is this time of year right now.
I understand that over the past few years, there's been a mass death of baby right whales.
Yeah.
That has been quite stunning. Can you tell me more about that? What's happened?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a long-term project monitoring southern right whales in this area since the early 1970s, actually. Those studies were begun by a very famous naturalist biologist, Roger Payne. And since then, the population has been studied regularly. However, only, I guess it's 9 years ago now, nobody had ever looked at mortality or, you know, even studied what the main causes of mortality of these whales were. So we implemented a stranding program, a program that basically monitors mortality throughout the breeding season. And what we have seen is that even though we really don't have a lot of previous data to know what is normal and what is abnormal, what we've seen is that in the last 3 years, particularly, we've had a huge increase in the number of baby whales dying. So ever since we began this program monitoring mortalities, we've seen baby mortalities account for about over 90% of the whales that die here every year. But in the past few years, we've seen that that percentage remained, but the numbers of whales that were dying were about one third of the numbers of whales that were being born. So we had a huge proportion of the babies that were born in over 3 years, actually, that were dying in that same season within weeks of being born or months in some cases. And from the information we have, this is the largest ever mortality recorded for a baleen whale when you compare it to the size of this population. So the proportion of animals dying is just huge and has never been recorded before.
What is causing that mortality?
I wish I knew. yeah, it's
no matter what we do, we still don't have enough information to know what's happening. There are causes we suspect. We've held workshops with experts to try and identify the causes of these mortalities. Actually, the International Whale Commission held a workshop of experts here last year because this problem was so worrying. And based on the evidence we have to date, which is not much, we really can't say what it is. I mean, there are suspicions are around something that is changing in conditions in terms of ability. It could be related to, you know, anything from climate change, fishing, or whatever. So what we have been seeing is kind of a the condition of the pups, of the calves, has not been that great. So maybe they're not enough food in their feeding ground. So when they come, they cannot sustain healthy calves for nursing. But we can't rule out disease or other causes such as toxins from algal blooms, for example, what are known normally as red tides. We suspect that in some cases that might have played a role, but we definitely don't have a consistent cause of mortality over the years. Contrary to what happens with northern right whales, especially in the Atlantic coast of the U.S., the East Coast, with pollution results and our interactions with fishing and entanglement and nets are not huge here. There are some events, but they're few compared to the numbers of, you know, the overall numbers of mortality. Those are not big issues. They do occur still, and they need careful attention, but they're not the main cause of these wide die-offs. And all I can say is that we're doing the best we can to try and identify the causes, but the reality is that whales live in the water, so when they die, they also die in the water, and we depend on the tides to bring the animals, the carcasses, onto the beach so that we can actually do postmortem examinations, what we call necropsies. And sometimes the process takes some time, and for the carcasses, the condition of those carcasses is not good by the time they drop on the beach, and therefore the information that we can get from them is very poor. And that is one of the main problems we have in terms of being able to determine what the cause of these mortalities is.
Can you tell me about the process, and how do you find these carcasses when they come to the beach? Do you patrol the beaches? How does it work?
Yeah, we have the coastline of Peninsula Valdez it's very hard to patrol. It's very, very, very extensive. And also there are many areas that are very isolated. We said earlier, they're not very mobile here. And so it is very, very difficult. And also many places that have no easy access by land. So we do some patrolling of the beaches by vehicle when we can, and we have to use telescopes and walk a lot to find the carcasses. But we also have begun doing aerial surveys. So we use airplanes to fly around the perimeter, the coastline, to find stranded whales. And then also we have implemented what we call the stranding network, which is basically just a network of citizens that report dead whales to us the minute they see them. So we reach out to, you know, artisanal fishermen, to scallop divers, to whale watching operators, guides, to the ranchers, people who live out in the ranches that mostly are sheep farms here that have a lot of stretches of coast. And basically anybody who can, you know, park rangers, anybody who can give us information, we reach to, and they have a number and they call us and let us know when there's a stranded whale. And then we get to them as soon as we can. For the work we do on the whales, we depend on the tides, which are very dramatic in Patagonia. So can only work when the animals are at
accessible and the tide is low for the, so that also limits our capacity to access the whales when they're fresh.
So what happens when you get a call? How do you get out there? You fly out there and land on this very difficult coastline?
No, we have to drive out there and take anything from 2 hours or 1 hour to 4 or 5 hours. And then if the whale is not a location where we can access it by a road, we just have to walk, in many cases, miles, with all our equipment on our back. And in some cases, when we're lucky, some bike rangers have small four-wheeled drive vehicles, kind of like motorcycles with four wheels, so they take us on some of those. But that rarely occurs. For the most part, we walk to the carcasses carrying all our stuff. So,
so you're in really good shape.
We are in very, yeah. My team is in very good shape, yeah. For all of this, for all the work.
And so
it is very necessary.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, it is very, I mean, if you want to be a wildlife vet, you better be in definitely, yes.
and then you're doing the necropsies on the beach. You're not bringing that whale with you.
Absolutely. There's no way we can move a 30-ton whale. Those are adult whales. When we get adult whales, it is really, really challenging to work on them. Those animals weigh 30,000 kilos, 30 tons. They're, you know, 12, 15 meters long. They're big, really big creatures. In the case of calves, they're smaller. I mean, but still, a newborn calf is over a ton. It's about 1,000 kilos. And, you can't move those either, no matter what you try and do. So, yeah, they're done on the beach. And with whatever time we have. So it's in the middle of winter, so we depend on the hours of daylight we have to work in. We're working huge knives, so we don't work at night. And also the tides, which also limit our, but my team has been getting really good at doing necropsies in short time now, because we had no other options, but still it is very challenging and very, very, I mean, it's very, very hard also to, you know, cut into a whale, an animal that size is very hard.
What does a necropsy involve? And how does it differ doing one on the beach versus if you were able to take the animal back to a lab and do it in the best circumstance? What, just to illustrate the challenges that you really have out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen some of the work that is done by the stranding networks in the U.S., and in many cases, you know, they have boats that bring the carcasses out, they have bulldozers, and they have cranes, and things like that. We just have to come on the whales. So, you know, even accessing them, you know, on top of them sometimes to cut through the blubber, you know, and access the organs inside, which we're trying to find to collect samples, is very, very challenging. So, I guess the main constraint is that we have no power tools available. So it's all based on how strong we are and the knives that we have to use. And it's just, and also, the other thing that is very challenging is the time constraint, as I was saying earlier. And also just not being comfortable. Winds here are very, very strong throughout the year, and it can be really, really cold. Also, sometimes it's actually nice to be inside the whale because it's warmer in there. But it is not very pleasant. It doesn't smell very good. Necropsies are challenging no matter where when you're doing, you know, large animals. Actually, in zoos, for example, when large animals die, they can't even take them into the necropsy rooms either. They have to do them outdoors somewhere because they're just massive. So for a large whale, I don't think there would be that many options, but definitely not having power tools available is challenging.
And then do you take samples of the organs or blubber back to test for toxins and whatnot? Or
yeah, we collect about 300 samples from each whale that dies or more. We try and collect samples from every tissue and every organ in the animal, plus That is to find out what the cause of death might be. So we test it for diseases, for toxins, for pollutants, for heavy metals, for anything you can think of. But then also we collect a huge number of samples just to learn about the biology of these species. Nobody, you know, again, we don't have access to these animals very frequently. So, you know, baleen, we collect baleen samples, for example, because you can do studies of the isotopes in the baleen, and that can tell you where they have been feeding, for example. So it's a really good way to learn, you know, about the feeding habits of these species and their migration patterns without deploying a tracking device to them, which is very hard to do in large whales. And we also collect just blubber of all sorts, even to look at, you know, the physical composition. Nobody knows exactly how their fat stores work and, you know, what functions they serve for the animal's physiology, and skin samples, ear samples to try and look at, determine their age. Even the lens inside their eyes can help you determine the age of an adult whale, for example. So we basically collect everything we can of these. And we actually collect many of those samples for other scientists interested in studying the right whales. And we just hand them over to them afterwards, just because we're fortunate to be able to have access to these animals.
Oh, interesting. How does an ear or an eye related sample tell you the age of the whale?
Well, for the eyes, the lenses in the eyes are used in many mammal species to determine age. So I don't know exactly how that is done, but there are definitely people who do that. So we collect the eye lenses for that. And there's also something about the way in which the bones in some parts of the ear grow or get mineralized over time that can also help you determine what the ages. I don't really know the details, but it's a fascinating process, and it's the kind of information you wouldn't know unless you did that.
Very fascinating.
Yeah. Sure.
So just switching from the sea to the air above the sea,
yeah.
I know you've done a lot of work with seabirds in Patagonia, and I'm curious, what are some of the species that you've worked on?
For penguins, Magellanic penguins, rockhopper penguins, gentoo penguins, all different and fascinating in their own little ways. And albatrosses, especially black-brow albatross, southern giant petrels, imperial cormorants, rock shags, kelp gulls, dolphin gulls, I don't know, so many.
so many
seabird species.
And which ones?
Yeah,
have you...
recently I've worked with black-brow albatross and imperial cormorants.
And which ones are your favorite, or most endearing?
That is a very difficult question. I don't know. I think, you know, all species have their charm. I mean, penguins are just fascinating and just cute also to watch. Again, I think there's something about, you know, those birds being completely out of their element when they're on land that just makes them really cute to watch. And but also, you know, again, they're these champions of the seas, the way they move in the water and the distances they travel, and, you know, their migration capacity to live in the oceans are just unbelievable. But then you come to, you know, albatrosses, and just to watch an albatross, you could just sit there and watch them fly. Or actually, what they do is they sail the wind. They never even move their wings. And it's just amazing, you know, and the distances they cover. They can go thousands of miles and one foraging trip. And, you know, they live in, you know, really, really bad sea conditions and the wind. So I don't know. It's just fascinating. All species are really lovely.
What have you done related to seabirds as far as research or helping them? Have there been mass die-offs as well? Or
I've investigated some massive die-offs. Most of the massive die-offs and seabirds have been related to what are called harmful algal blooms or red tides. So those are toxins that are produced by some sorts of phyto or zooplankton that at some point become toxic. And these events seem to be becoming more frequent as climate changes and ocean temperatures change. and also because of some of the nutrients we pour into the water. So some of these events become more frequent and then can affect a large number of seabirds. But also I've been just doing, I've been doing some health surveillance or health monitoring, which is looking at diseases in birds and trying to establish what we call baseline or normal values, because we want to, if a mass die-off occurred at some point, you would have to know what was normal and what was there before the mass die-off to be able to say that it was a disease or not. So, in many cases, you know, this information is very hard to come across with species that are not in zoos or not available any other way. And it is very critical for seabirds, especially because they breed in colonies, in very tightly packed colonies. So if any disease was to affect a breeding colony, it would spread really, really quickly. And it could basically wipe out an entire colony or an entire population at once. So disease monitoring has been very significant. And also together with that, I've been involved in other studies. In some cases, just describing the biology of the species again, for example, for southern giant petrels, where nothing is known, look at their feeding habits and trying to identify conservation issues or conservation threats. And recently, I've undertaken a study with a student of mine in cormorants, and we'll later expand it to Magellanic penguins, trying to use what are somewhat more common species or more abundant species to see if we can find indicators of health, of good condition, that would serve as, again, I have to use the word indicators, but that they would let you know that a bird would have a good reproductive success. And what we're hoping is that if we can find safely that your cholesterol values were between so and so and your red cells were at such and such a value, I could kind of forecast that within this breeding season, if there was no unusual event, that you would have, you know, one or two healthy chicks. And the reason why we're trying to do this is because some of the some seabirds, such as the rockhopper penguins, are not doing that well, and they kind of regularly get into these cycles where they have a good year where they fledge, you know, a good number of young, but then they have many years when none of their chicks fledge. So they call it, you know, the numbers of those populations start declining very rapidly. So what we're trying to see is if we can identify some of these indicators in common species that we could later apply to these species that are having conservation problems now, and see if we could use that as a mechanism to forecast, you know, if they were do good or bad in a determined year.
Do you have any results from that study yet?
We have just begun this study in the past few months, so I'm hoping that in a couple of years, this is a study for a PhD student that's working with me, so maybe in 2 or 3 years we'll have something. So we haven't even began processing the samples we collected this year, so I can't even venture any idea of what's going to happen. I mean, there have been studies that have looked at some aspects of their physiology and related it to reproductive success, but they haven't really been as complete as the ones that we are trying to look at. We're looking at many, many more indicators that had never, that, you know, at once. And so we'll try and see what matches or what is a good indicator for reproductive success. We'll see.
Well, I look forward to checking back with you on that study. Well, I really appreciate the time that you've spent talking with me.
Sure, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with the Wildlife Conservation Society's Marcella Uhart about her veterinary experiences with wildlife in Patagonia, Argentina. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife Live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.